episode 8. Welcome to episode 8 of the Thinking Habits podcast. 8 weeks has gone very quickly. It's been fun so far. I'm here with Pam.
Again, hello.
And we are tackling a subject that we talk about quite a lot in between us and through a couple of the social media channels that we're involved in, a couple of podcasts are very open about this subject as well. It's the subject of guilt, and connected to that, the subject of shame. Guilt and shame inevitably tied together. How this came about, why we decided to discuss it this week, was because if you remember last week, I was laid up with back pain and abdominal pain, having injured myself while lifting something incorrectly, and I was off work for a few days because I couldn't sit up, let alone drive. As it turns out, I'd managed to give myself a severe abdominal strain and a hernia, so that's fun. But regardless of that, and regardless of all the painkillers and the noticeable inability to move properly, I just was racked with guilt about not being at work. You know, I was thinking, oh God, because I'm leaving my current job soon, and I'm trying to hand things over, and I was thinking, oh Jesus, they're going to be freaking out, and there's stuff that needs doing, and it was making me more anxious being at home. And in the end, I ended up sort of logging in a couple of times and answering some emails and pointing people in the right direction, when really I should have been focusing on getting better, because I wasn't doing anything for anybody really. I was no use to anyone while I was laid up. I'm still not 100% now. It's still very painful, but at least I'm recording this podcast vertically, which is nice. But it got me looking at a few articles, and we've been talking about it quite a lot this week, haven't we?
Yeah.
And there was an article about, should I feel guilty about taking sick days? And the person who run this, it's kind of like an online advice column, and this particular guy, it really hit the nail on the head. You know, if you're ill, you're ill. And I've said this to colleagues, you know, when I've managed people, if they're ill, you know, if they've got norovirus or they've twisted their ankle or whatever, and they're feeling guilty about not coming in, I say to them, look, nobody's indispensable. You're ill. It's not your fault. You know, if you were skiving off, then that's something different. But, you know, the advice that's given on this website is take a deep breath. They'll survive without you. And I think, you know, that's something that I find quite difficult.
Yeah. There's, and I mean, also going in can be worse than staying off, because you prolong whatever illness it is. If it's contagious, yeah, no one else wants it.
No.
Like, you know, when I've been in office environments, if someone's got a really bad cold
or God forbid, noro,
then I don't want it.
No.
And you know, if I remember one particular case. So there was what a colleague said. I need to let you know, my son's had chicken pox all this week.
Oh.
And I was like, well, I hope you haven't got it, because I've had chicken pox, but I can get shingles from you, and
your immune system would freak
out at that. So, but you know, I felt like I couldn't stay off, but it's all fine.
That's something that comes later on when we discuss it. Is the fact that your guilt can actually end up putting people at risk in extreme circumstances.
Yeah.
So another thing he says about, you know, taking sick days is separate your job's expectations from reality. That can be harder to do than you'd expect. Like I said, nobody's indispensable, but what happens sometimes is that there is an unnaturally high level of expectation put on people. If you give an inch, people will take a mile. And that's not to say that it's often done deliberately. It's just that there's so-and-so can do that really well. Let's leave that to them.
I've certainly had that, and I know you have as well.
Yeah, I mean, for these 4 days that I've been off, I checked my emails in 4 days, and there was a number of emails which, you know, my out-of-office says I'm not in. They could have been dealt with, but they also knew I was coming back.
Yeah.
So they've kind of left it, which is fine in any normal circumstances, but they also know that I'm not going to be there in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
It's kind of an opportunity for them to really look to where these things go.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's an anomaly. That's not always the case. You know, it just happens to have fallen in this way. And then the next option is check in if you must, but do it comfortably. Now, see, that's a double-edged sword. That's very risky, because I check in, and it's almost like you check in with one eye open, and you press the refresh button, and you think, oh,
like it's going to explode.
Yeah, and you know, some of the stuff that came out was like, oh God. There's issues that have come out of them. some things at work which I needed to fix because there was a problem with this, with the software and whatever. I can fix it, and that's fine. But again, you get drawn in, and I start to think, right, okay, well, am I going to have to go in? Because I can't. I still couldn't drive at the time. So it's very hard to divorce yourself from that when you feel a tremendous sense of responsibility for something that you're doing. You know, and like I said to you, I'm very proud of the stuff that I do at work. But yeah. So when things go wrong, I feel an obligation to make it right. And being ill doesn't help, because I have a guilt complex a mile wide on a good day, let alone when I'm off sick.
Yeah.
But the final one that we'll come back to a few times in this, it's probably the most important, is just to remember that you work to live, you don't live to work. Some people do. Some people, you know, some people are complete workaholics and they like it like that. I don't.
No.
I absolutely don't. You know, I do my hours and I put my effort in those hours, but when I'm off, I'm off, and I want to be off. I've done the 24/7 rotor, I've done the on-call, I've done the ridiculous shift patterns when I was a nurse.
Yeah.
It doesn't work for me. And I had to be mindful of that. I had to be really reflective on whether or not that was going to work for me long term.
Yeah, I think there's very few people who that kind of irregular pattern works long term. I think it's something you can... Most people can do it for a while, but very few people can do it as an ongoing as an ongoing thing. I mean, people have been nurses for 30 years.
Karen, retired recently. She was a mental health nurse for 38 years, you know, and a lot of that was working in the prison where I worked. And I that was shift works, night work, you know, night shifts, odd shifts, odd hours, long days. I find that absolutely incredible that somebody can have the fortitude to manage to do that for that long, because it did my head in after 5 years.
Yeah.
Although, you know, there was other reasons why my head was done in, but shift work didn't help.
No.
So when we're talking about guilt and shame, you did some kind of summing up of those things, didn't you? So what about guilt, first of all?
Guilt. So the most obvious, there's article I read split it out into five sort of distinct-ish areas.
Yeah, that was Psychology Today, wasn't it? We'll put a link to that article up.
Because there's a lot of other articles like coping mechanisms and things. Mm. So the most obvious type of guilt is for something you did. I think absolutely everyone can relate to that not feeling guilt for something that you obviously did. Mm. Is a sign of psychopathy.
Yes, it is. Although there is an argument in an article which I read yesterday that there is a bit of evidence to suggest that psychopaths do feel guilt; they just repress it.
That makes sense.
They just override it due to their narcissism. So, I mean, in the main, they don't. But there is a lot of evidence to suggest that they might.
Yeah,
they're still psychopaths at the end of the day. So, you know.
And there's guilt for something you didn't do but want to. So I don't know. It could be the most obvious is wanting to cheat on your partner but not acting on it. But then you'll feel guilty for wanting to. And then there's something that you think you did. So it could be you think you've let someone down, and actually it turns out that it could be something that hasn't even registered with them.
Yeah.
But because you think that you've hurt them or let them down or wronged them in some way, you feel guilty for it.
That one particular, that's something you think you did. We talk about that quite a lot.
Yes.
Amongst ourselves and amongst friends, and we know several people who, when we talk about the fear, or beer fear, or, you know, the morning after fear, several times.
Post-party guilt.
Yeah, when you've gone out and take an ale to an excess, and then you wake up in the morning and you can't quite remember what you said, but you have an overwhelming sense of dread that it might have been something awful. I mean, I'm 41, so a lot of my formative years weren't recorded on a smartphone, so I'm quite grateful for that. But, you know, I had the fear then, but you had to kind of just deal with it, because there was no real way of plotting a course back through the night, because people didn't bring cameras out, people didn't have phones with them, you didn't see them again for a week. So by that point, people have forgotten about it. So the kind of emphasis on that kind of dread and that kind of existential crisis that you get when a hangover is coursing through your system is it was less paramount. But now with everything you would ever want in the palm of your hand, it's like the
Sunday morning notification. So and so has tagged you in a photo on Facebook, and like, I don't remember anyone taking any pictures. But the thing to remember is like, and something that I kind of come back to. Well, there's two things. There's one, I can't remember where I read it or who said it to me, but other people don't think about you nearly as much as you think they do.
Yeah,
and it's
that's very true.
Even if you did do something embarrassing, a lot of people probably didn't even notice, or they've forgotten about it.
And they were all in the same state as you.
Yes.
Anyway,
and
so
also,
they didn't remember. Yeah.
I don't remember every conversation I've had with people when I've not been drinking at all, or you know, I can completely forget parts of my day because it just wasn't very interesting.
Yeah.
And then when you think back and you go, well, I can't plot a course through that night. And then you think, well, actually, I didn't get in a state.
Mm.
I didn't overdo anything. And I probably couldn't plot a course through the night before when I didn't really do much.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
absolutely. So there's getting that balance. But yeah, I think that some people are definitely more prone to something you think you did.
Yeah.
Category of guilt.
My brain defaults to catastrophe.
Yeah.
And alongside that catastrophe, chained to it is
guilt, everyone hates
is guilt and responsibility. So something terrible's happened. It's almost inevitably my fault. And then you've got the little shame goblin that sits on top of that as well, which is great.
Everyone else thinks it's your fault.
Everyone else thinks it's your fault too. So one of the interesting parts of that really is the morning after. It just seems like an audit.
Yeah,
you know, you've got to go through everything. But you know, I mean, let's face it. One of the best ways of getting out of that is not to drink.
Which, yes,
you know, some people find it better not to drink. Some people find that I know of a couple of people whose morning after shame spiral was enough to make them stop drinking. For me, I've certainly cut down, and. You know, I think also kind of understood that it's taken a while because, you know, self-esteem issues aside, you need to convince yourself, you need to really believe in yourself as the fact that you aren't necessarily going to do something dreadful. And if you were going to do something dreadful, somebody would stop you.
Yeah.
You know, and you would stop yourself because, you know, I know on a daily basis that I've got a moral compass that guides me the right way.
Yes.
I might be a bit of a knob, I might say something that, you know, I might chuck a joke out that doesn't land. But that joke that doesn't land will keep me awake for weeks.
Say something a bit insensitive, even accidentally. It, you know, that you'll feel guilt over that, and it probably didn't even register with whoever you were telling, you know. Mm. Or even if it didn't land and they went, oh, that's a bit.
Yeah, that was a bit much.
A bit much. Then it go. They forget about it.
Yeah, of course.
Until you remind them, they go, "Oh, yeah."
Yeah, I forgot about that. That was a bit daft, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then that's it. It's blown over, which is exactly what it would be the other way round as well. And I think, but when you're under the spotlight,
yes,
you emphasise that quite a lot.
Yes.
So we'll probably come back to the fear because it comes back to you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, but the next guilt, there's another couple, isn't there?
Yeah. So didn't do enough to help someone. So, like examples. So if someone's been going through a hard time with something, you know, maybe a relationship breaking down, or could be struggling with drinking or substance abuse, you know, drugs, or just, you know, struggling with depression, you're not coping, and you didn't realise, or you maybe think back and think, well, why didn't I spot that?
Yeah.
And you know, so you get feelings of guilt from that, and very often it will come back to, realistically, there was no way you could, because they could have been putting up a front that everything was fine.
Yeah.
So
like when I was ill.
Yeah. There was things that, in retrospect, I should have noticed, but I didn't want there to be anything wrong. So when you told me you were fine,
yeah,
I chose to believe that, even though probably deep down I knew that you were keeping it from, but not ready to deal with it.
But I also actively hid it from you as well. And interestingly, I have the same sort of guilt about that, about something I did or didn't do that I wanted to, was the fact that I didn't tell you, I didn't speak to you about it. And I know that that caused problems, and I know it probably ended up making my relapse or illness last longer than it could have done, if I'd been honest. But when you're in that state, one, you think you can deal with it, and then when it gets too far to deal with, it then becomes an insurmountable object then. Well, I can't tell them now because this is mine, you know, it's too big now.
It's gone too far, yeah.
Until it breaks.
Yeah.
And until it breaks. Now I'm much better at that. I'll tell you when I'm having a hard time.
And the final one, which is doing better than someone else is how they've categorised it, but comes down to like survivor guilt.
Yeah.
And I think, but doing better than someone else is, you know, say if you're feeling depression, not wanting to seek therapy because you feel like you're not depressed enough. People worse off, and yeah. But it doesn't take away, or you know, an illness or a disability, and say, yeah, but you know, some other people have got it worse, and say, yeah, there'll be loads of people who've got it worse.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take away from what you're feeling. I know we've had that when you've been in pain, and you've gone, oh, I feel really guilty because you're in pain all the time. And it's like, yes, I am. But it doesn't take away from
the fact that I'm in pain.
Yeah. I'd rather not be, but I'd rather you weren't in pain either. It's not a competition.
No, it's not. Well, I mean, if it was, you'd win. But but yeah, no, that took a little getting used to. It's hard to get used to the fact that your suffering, your pain, your depression, your illness, your broken arm, your headache, it doesn't lose validity just because someone else has got a worse headache than you. It only then becomes a problem when you actively assert that yours is the worst.
Yeah.
And I, you know, we can all be drama queens from now and
again. Oh, yeah.
Now and again. I mean, I very rarely, obviously. But you can back that up.
I have a
tendency to histrionic sometimes when I'm tired and I'm upset, or when I'm grumpy, or when I'm awake. But...
No, I think everyone has that, you know. I'm been quite lucky. I haven't had a migraine for a long time. But, you know, sometimes when I do get a migraine, I say, well, this is it. I'm never going to feel better again.
Yeah.
This is my life now.
Yeah.
And it's like when I've had proper flu twice in my life. The last time, I think I was in my early 20s, and I actually thought I was dying, and I thought that was how I was going to feel for the rest of my life, which was probably about a week.
Yeah, I remember, I'm just thinking back to when I got flu over the millennium. I was so annoyed because I had so much sweet overtime booked as well. But it was called the chicken flu. It was from like Hong Kong or something.
Right.
And I remember 2 days before the millennium, I started feeling a bit, because proper flu comes at you like a freight train, doesn't it? It's not a slow decline.
I had to go home from work. I was absolutely fine. Went out for coffee with a colleague and picked my coffee up, took a sip of it and just went, I don't feel well.
Mm.
Went back to work and same colleague actually drove me home because I was just sat at my desk, unable to do anything.
I remember getting home and I was like, I got upstairs and I was like, oh God, I feel a bit, oh, maybe swing out or I'm tired. And about an hour later, the sweats start, don't they? You just go cold and go clammy. And I was like, no, I'm going downhill fast. And I went to bed and I woke up. And I ended up sleeping in the other room because I was just... I was hallucinating. I was thrashing around. I was sweating at buckets. And I genuinely... The thing that I remember most vividly about that incident was that I crawled to the toilet in the middle of the night and I hallucinated. I can remember it to this day so vividly. There was a roast chicken on the landing dancing, waving at me like that, going, hey, you can't get to the toilet. I was like, right, okay, that's it, I'm out, I'm checking out, I'm done.
Yeah.
And I managed to get to the toilet, and then I think it took me about an hour and a half or whatever, but then I went back to bed, and I was wrong for about 2 weeks. It took me 2 weeks to get out of that one. It was horrific. And now, I because of that incident, I never say that I've got flu.
No.
I've got a bad cold.
Yeah.
But until you've actually had flu, you don't really know what flu is.
No.
And that's, yeah. I'll tell you what, I did not feel guilty about not going into work then.
No.
Oh, I couldn't hardly.
Well, is it the difference? Didn't they say there's the difference between a bad cold and flu is if you're lying on the sofa and you see a £50, and someone drops a £50 note.
Mm.
If it was flu, you wouldn't bother to pick it up.
No. What's 50? What use is 50 quid? Yeah. You're going to die anyway.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know if it's just you feel miserable because you're so feeling so rotten, or if the mood is part of the illness.
But it ties in quite well with this guilt and shame thing, because you've got the illness and the mood, and then the mood and then the illness, and it's a circular thing.
Yeah.
And circling back quite neatly, I thought, to guilt and shame. Shame ties in with guilt very, very easily, doesn't
it? So shame, again, they've split it down into five types. So self-awareness, so being overly self-conscious. I suppose self-consciousness rather than self-awareness. So wearing a suit, a posh suit, to a casual dude turning up, everyone else is in jeans and t-shirts, and then you spend the entire time thinking that everyone's looking at you, wondering why you're so overdressed, when they're probably just, you know, probably crosses a few people's minds, and maybe there'll be a comment or two, but it's just, they might think you've gone straight from work or something.
Yeah. Or they might come up to you and go, you look very smart. Yeah. You're very nice. Yeah. So it could go the other way.
Yeah. So being overly aware of having a set of rules or norms in your head, and there's a definite right and wrong, and it's entirely your own doing.
That example, the suit to a casual dude, has just reminded me of something awful that happened to me when I was about 16. We were having a party at friend Richard's house. I say friend, you'll make your own mind up after this one. But he basically had the idea that everybody should turn up in drag, just for a laugh.
Yeah.
Lads, let's all turn up in drag. So I turned up in drag. No one else was in drag.
Oh.
They absolutely rinsed me. And I was just like, you bunch of bastards. But what was weird was crippling shame for about 5 minutes, until I realised that it was a wind up and there's nothing I could have done about it.
Yeah.
And then I just got drunk with the rest of them, and it was glossed over.
And again, you were wearing a pretty frock.
I was wearing a sweet tie dye miniskirt and fishnets. I looked the bomb. As well, you know, you've seen me in fishnets.
That's a story for another time.
But yeah, but that's weird, because on the face of it, that could be a phenomenally shameful event, but I've done way less intense kind of things like that, and I feel way more shame
I suppose something like that, they probably, you just get that and you own it.
I owned it, I'll tell you. And luckily, again, no phones, no cameras. Woo! So I don't think any pictures exist, and that's probably for the best.
So, self-blame. It's the attribution theory. So humans will automatically think that everything has a cause. And where the shame comes into it is that you'll then put that onto yourself. You'll find a way that you've caused whatever situation it is, so you feel shame about that.
So it's
guilt and
shame. you need to find what caused it, and unless you can find an absolute cause elsewhere, it's always you.
Because
you can't, the human brain doesn't naturally like unanswered questions.
No, it doesn't like that things just happen sometimes. You will find it's like lying about something. If there's something it's something like as trivial as not going to something, like thinking about, oh, I could skive off work today. even if I wasn't even going to leave the house, my mind immediately will start plotting all the ways I could get caught.
Yeah.
And, you know, and to people say, like, oh, are you never tempted to do that? And it's like, well, no, because my mind will immediately come up with the most convoluted, far-fetched ways that I would get caught out. And I would feel so guilty that I wouldn't enjoy it anyway.
But that's also empathy as well, because you don't want to let people down, and that would be purely by your own actions that you'd end up letting somebody down. So empathy then generates the preemptive guilt and shame there as well, doesn't it? And that ties into the kind of the next couple, isn't it? The standards and personal trait and self-esteem, really. They're the last three.
So standards, personal traits, and self-esteem, they all really tie together. So acting against a set of rules, and it could be social rules, things like behaving inappropriately at an event. So everyone thinks of laughing at a funeral, or appearing happy, you would feel ashamed of that.
I think that's a bit juxtaposed, though, because I've laughed at a funeral. When in context, but I think if you went there and took the piss, I think that's slightly different.
People would feel guilty for being secretly glad that someone's dead.
Absolutely.
I think that's something that no one would want to admit.
Want to admit to,
however much they might think it privately.
Absolutely. And I think if you feel it very strongly, and I think if you go to a funeral where people know you didn't like the person, you would probably feel that that's written all over your face as well. So that's probably something that would generate that guilt and shame.
And that comes out the personal trait. So whether you're highly self-conscious or not at all. I mean, I've been incredibly self-conscious for as long as I can remember, and that has led to things like almost getting myself into trouble because I've not wanted to speak up about things, and I've felt guilty about pointing something out. That has then made things worse.
Absolutely. In the current role that I'm in, I feel very guilty about the fact that there's a lot of work that still needs doing.
Yeah.
But my contract is up.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, my contract's up.
Yeah.
So. I can only do what I can do. I am only one man, and I think when you start taking on the responsibilities of other people, and by that token, the associated guilt and shame of other people for not doing their bit, it becomes insurmountable, and you can't work like that.
No. Another important aspect of guilt is projected guilt. So in the kind that you can see in gaslighting relationships, and we've not talked about that at all.
No, I mean that's a podcast in itself. That is such a destructive behaviour, and it's quite prominent in the media at the moment as well, isn't it?
I think you're right. That's the whole other discussion.
But gaslighting, projected guilt in itself, gaslighting in summary. Do you want to
summarise that gaslighting? So that can be making someone believe that they're doing the wrong thing and that things are their fault, and projecting behaviours onto them and making them believe that they're at fault for things they're not.
It comes from a film, Gaslight, I think it's called, from the 1940s, I think, which is about somebody who basically gets slowly over time is almost brainwashed. It is a form of brainwashing, in the sense that they are guilt is attributed to them for things that they didn't do. They are convinced by their partner that they've done things, or they haven't done things, or they've said things or not that puts them at fault. And it's something as simple as, well, I didn't say that. You must be going mental. But that once or twice. I mean, everybody does that. Everybody has arguments. You know, we had a tiff recently where neither of us could agree what we'd said or not said, and when you're trying to fight your corner, it's quite you get quite defensive, don't you?
And it just gets a bit silly.
Yeah, but when you can both recognise that, that's fine. You know, everybody has arguments, but gaslighting is more insidious. People who gaslight typically use the following techniques. They tell blatant lies. You know it's an outright lie, yet they're telling you this lie with a straight face, but they will bully their way through with that lie.
Yeah.
They deny they ever said something, even though you have proof. I mean, look at yesterday. Donald Trump, on video, on camera, said that the Brexit would ruin the relationship with the US, and then 2 hours later he says it was fake news and he said it will be fine, even though it's literally on camera.
Yeah,
it's, I mean, he's a classic example of somebody who gaslights people.
He's gaslighting an entire sector,
everybody other than himself.
So
they use what is near and dear to you as ammunition. They know how important their kids are to you, so they know, and they know how important your identity is to you, so they will start attacking that. They'll start eroding that. And we know through groups of friends a couple of people who have gone through that, and they are struggling to regain their identity years later. And it's incredibly damaging and insidious. And we're only just starting to see the sort of chrysalis of the old person coming back now, aren't we?
Yes. Yeah.
Their actions don't match their words. So when dealing with a person or identity that gaslights, look at what they're doing rather than what they're saying. What they're saying means nothing. It's just talk. What they do is the issue. So if they're saying something nice but doing something horrible,
you know,
that's pretty classic.
Yeah.
They'll throw in positive reinforcement to confuse you. So the person or entity that's cutting you down, telling you that you don't have any value, is now praising you for something you did. That adds to the sense of unease because you don't know where they're going to go next. And that's difficult. They know that confusion weakens people, so they'll talk around in an argument. They'll project, and then they'll try and align people against you. Now, in and of themselves, you know, it's important to say that in and of themselves, in isolation, a lot of those behaviours everybody does because you are we're a defensive species.
Yeah.
But it's when that is calculated and repetitive and manipulative to the point where it is to the conscious detriment of somebody else, that's when it becomes very, very dangerous.
And it's
a form of brainwashing, and it's definitely a form of domestic abuse, and it's definitely something that has been highlighted recently in the media, and rightly so. And I think more needs to be done about raising awareness of that, but that guilt and shame that the person who's been gaslighted feels is projected. It's somebody else's guilt that's been forced onto them. And if you're a person who naturally feels guilt and shame, it's not going to be that hard to reinforce that.
No.
Is it?
No, and it's, I think a lot of it can start with playing up to people's vulnerabilities. Mm. You know, if you know someone has a natural predisposition to being unsure of themselves in maybe a social setting, is prone to social anxiety, playing on things that would provoke that, would provoke those feelings, so that almost they can come in and be the protector.
Yeah.
And it creates this kind of, to create a sort of dependency.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's all about control. It's a form of control.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it's really weird when you look at some of these things, because I know, we've had this conversation recently. We were talking about gaslighting the other day. I know that both of us, in at least one occasion, have done one of these things in an argument.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's very interesting, because when we talk about that and we reflect on that later, we're both sensible enough to be able to call that out. I mean, you know, you've called me out on that a couple of times, and you know,
and vice versa,
absolutely. But then that puts me right back in that bottom corner of shame.
Yes.
I never intentionally want to do that.
No.
To identify behaviours like that, even as a one-off, is abhorrent to me.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I have to be mindful of the fact that as human beings, we need to address these things and work on them.
Yeah, and I think that that ties back into where guilt can be a positive thing, because it's the old, you know, the saying, it leaves a bad taste in your mouth. It's like, I'm not very happy with myself for doing that. No. And it, but it's a good thing that you're not happy with yourself, because you're recognising that your behaviour is, or you know, your words or your actions have hurt someone to some extent.
Mm.
And even if, you know, if I've said something and then I know that it hurt you at the time or it upset you at the time, that makes me feel bad.
Mm.
But it's good that it makes me feel bad, because
it, if it made you feel good, then
yeah, then there's a deeper issue. Thing, yeah, there's deeper issues. Yeah. But then, you know, it would hopefully make me think twice about doing something in the future. And it's like, it, even if it was completely unintentional, it could be just something I didn't think of.
Mm. Absolutely.
That I should have done. And you know, it can very easily then go round in circles of feeling bad.
Mm.
You feel bad that you did it, and then you neglect other things, and the whole thing goes.
Yeah, it is difficult, but I think what comes out of this particular subject is the most important thing is dialogue.
Yes.
But then, you know, if you're in a gaslighting relationship, dialogue's going to be difficult. But I think what that extends to is talk to somebody else.
Yeah, because the person, it seems to be in gaslighting, they obviously, their first thing they're going to do is deny that there's, I don't know what you're talking, deny that there's a problem.
Mm.
And you can be they can make you feel that you're worrying about something completely insignificant. Yeah. And they'll downplay any concerns.
I think it's worth noting that the in some of the examples we're talking about people we know, I certainly feel, not to anywhere near the same extent as the main protagonist, but I feel to a certain extent gaslit by that relationship, because we didn't notice things going on until much later.
Mm.
Because the projection and the reality were different.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So there was a little bit of research. There's a website called Counselling Directory, and there's a psychologist called Joshua Miles who's written a nice little summation of guilt and shame, which kind of rounds it off a little bit, which I found really useful. So I'm going to read it in its entirety, but I'll put the link up because I think it's worth reading. It's quite a long piece. So the feeling of guilt could be described as our conscience being bothered by an action we have taken, which we then later regret. However, there are several types of guilt, such as guilt for an action we took or did not take, or for which we feel ashamed, unworthy, or embarrassed. This could be referred to as true guilt. However, there is also false guilt, which is when we feel guilty for something which we had no control over. This is a form of guilt which can often be more destructive and damaging, and on the whole is unproductive with detrimental consequences. So we've talked about that. So yeah. that's you know, survivor guilt is something like, you know, you have no control over that. You know, the fear to a certain extent, you don't really have an awful lot of control over that, because it's often the actions of others that give you that fear and shame. Guilt can have important healing properties, and I think this is quite important. It's something we haven't really touched on. It can allow for personal growth and development. It can also be a very constructive emotion. When we feel guilty, we are recognising that one of our actions was wrong and could have caused harm to another. We feel sorry for what we have done, and if we are able to apologise, we can find ourselves feeling less heavy and gain some personal development and growth. As with guilt, shame is with us from an early age, with some theories placing it as early as 15 months. Shame could be described as the discomfort we experience if we do not live up to the expectations or beliefs of others, and the embarrassment or remorse we experience when we feel we've let someone down and expect that we will receive their scorn and ridicule. This can happen if we breach or alter the rules of social engagement or behave in a way which is deemed as unacceptable to others. This type of shame might not occur if we are able to hide or mask our acts of behaviour which are deemed inappropriate to others. However, another way of looking at shame is that it comes from our own sense of self-disapproval. It is this type of shame which is much harder to mask or avoid. It can leave us feeling disgraced, inadequate, ridiculous, defective, or not worthy. Now, that's very powerful, because those kind of words, those defective, ridiculous, not worthy, if you are predisposed to depression and anxiety, they are strong, strong themes that go throughout your psychic. For me, definitely. Yeah. I will predispose myself to... I don't like receiving praise. I'm very anxious and embarrassed about receiving praise, because my default position is inadequate or not worthy. So, you know, I find that very difficult.
Yeah, I'm very similar in that respect, because if someone praises me for something, I will be thinking, yeah, but I could have done it better, or I could have done it quicker, or and I'll immediately think of the things that didn't get done.
Mm.
And I think it can be quite easy sometimes to focus on the shortcomings rather than the achievements.
Yeah.
You know, certainly in, you know, you're talking about your contract coming to an end and there's still a lot to do.
Yeah.
But there's so much that has been achieved over your time there in various splintered roles, but you know that you've helped implement something. You know, you've achieved an awful lot, and there's obviously going to be an ongoing process when you're not there.
I think the best way I can describe how positives and negatives and praise and problems manifest in my brain is that if I've got a Jenga tower. And my Jenga tower, you know, it's 3 blocks by 3 blocks.
Yeah,
by three,
yeah.
And you build it up and up and up. Each bit of praise, each bit of good that I've done is one block.
Mm-hmm.
So I build up an account of praise, you know, an account of good things that I've done. But regardless of that tower could be 40 metres tall.
Yeah.
One wrong thing, if I do one wrong thing, in my head, that tower is knocked over. It's gone.
Yes,
it's gone. It doesn't take, you know, there should be a balance, you know. Okay, I did this wrong, but I've still got all this, you know.
Yeah.
So, I offset one for one.
Yeah.
No. For me, gone. No, I have to start again. So for me, I feel this tremendous sense of obligation that I have to work extra hard.
Yes.
If I make a mistake.
Yeah.
So I try not to make mistakes. But then if I'm overly picky about things and then I take on too much because I'm trying to please people, I'll take on too much, I'll get overly picky, I'll get myself into a right mess, and then I'll make a mistake.
Yeah.
So I'm perpetuating that guilt, shame spiral.
Yes, and I think
by my own actions.
You can try to be too much of a pleaser and you take on too much and end up not doing any of it very well.
Yes.
I know that's a situation we've both...
Yes,
spinning.
And what I often find, I mean, you've talked about this a couple of times, is that you take on so many little things, you go, right, I've got to do this, I've got to do this, I've got to do this, and then the list becomes 5, 10, 15 things. So the default position then is to hide under the duvet.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it just becomes insurmountable, whereas what it would be, the best way to tackle that is to just start at the beginning, work your way down, or prioritise them, the ones you can get done quickly, get those done out the way.
Get them out the way.
Mm. Yeah, or the most onerous one. I'm a bit of a masochist, I tend to go for the most onerous one first.
Yeah.
Because if I can get that out the way, everything else is a breeze. But then that doesn't often work for everybody.
No.
But I'm also somebody who likes stand-up presentations as opposed to sit-down meetings, so there's something fundamentally wrong with me.
Yes.
One of the things, I've just been looking for it while we've been talking, because we were talking about how in circling back to the something you think you did and the fear and the shame thing, you said something really pertinent, which was that people don't think about you as much as you think they do.
Yeah.
And there was something I shared on Facebook a few months ago, which came from Reddit. And it's a simple paragraph, but it's absolutely, it blew my mind. And the title of this particular post is, "A different version of you exists in the mind of everyone who knows you." So the gist is, this chap has read a book, and the main character goes crazy when he realizes nobody really knows him. And the gist goes thus. The gist is that the person you think of as yourself exists only for you, and even you don't really know what that is. Every person you meet, have a relationship with, or make eye contact with on the street creates a version of you in their heads. You are not the same person to your mum, your dad, your siblings. You're not the same person as you are to your co-workers, your neighbours, or your other friends. There are thousands of different versions of you out there in people's minds. A you exists in each version, and yet your you, yourself, isn't really a someone at all.
Wow.
And that's, I mean, it's incredible, and it's absolutely true, isn't it? Because I know how I perceive myself.
Yeah.
But even recording this podcast, episode one, my voice sounds completely different. It feels alien. It's not me.
Yeah, yeah.
I know what it sounds like when it resonates in my head, but it's not me.
Mm.
And when I see myself on camera, that's not me. That's not how I see myself. It's really strange.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that, you know, we've been married for 12 years, 11 years, a million years. It seems like longer.
Forever.
But, no. But that really blew my mind to think that the you that I know
mm-hmm.
is not the you that you know,
no.
even though we feel like we know each other inside out.
Yeah.
But it's almost like I know a projection of you.
Yeah.
Whereas only you know the you, but according to that, even you don't know the you because it's an amalgam. It's like a gestalt entity of all these thousands of other yous that have. Because I'm the me to you.
to me to you.
To me to you. I'm the me to you. I'm myself when I'm talking to you.
Yes.
But the me that you see is different. But I know that the myself I am when I'm with you is different to the myself that I am when I'm with my mum.
Yeah.
Because my traits change slightly.
Yes.
There's learned behaviours there.
Yeah.
So I'm aware. It's still me.
Yeah.
But it's like a mum me. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. I'm aware of that.
Yes.
But at the same time, I still carry those with me when I'm me. So am I a gestalt entity of all those different things or not?
This is getting very deep.
I need to lie down.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, but it's really interesting. It's something to ponder on, and I think it's a really fascinating subject that we can get into quite a lot. And I think I'd really like to hear people's interpretations of, you know, guilt and shame and how they've managed it and worked with it. So podcast@thinkinghabits.co.uk is the email address, or follow us on the socials at Thinking Habits on Instagram and Twitter. So yeah, by all means, please do let us know what you think. One thing to mention is we talked a little bit about one of the podcasts that we listen to on the regular, which is Ellis James and John Robbins' podcast, and they talk very, very openly about guilt and shame. John Robbins has built a comedy career on analysing his own sense of guilt and shame,
yeah.
and his sense of self-worth, and it's, there are so many things in his comedy and in his daily life that resonate very closely with me, because he comes from a very similar bottom corner of the graph in terms of his self-image and being ridiculous or defective or not worthy, and he talks about shame in a very honest and open way, and it is genuinely one of the things that made me really reflect on how I deal with it myself.
They talk
about depression as the darkness, and for me that helps to normalize it, because people can identify with that. Everybody goes through that shadow period from time to time. But he has a little segment in this podcast called John's Shamewell, where people write in and they email in the things that keep them awake at night, because everybody's got one. You know, you just pop your head down on the pillow and then all of a sudden you are transported back to that time when you were 18 and you said something dreadful. Nobody else remembers it, but you do. And so it comes, you know, these stories, some of them are, you think, oh, you know, I wouldn't feel shame about that. I don't even know why they've written in. But obviously to them,
yeah.
it means a great deal.
Yeah, yeah.
Other stories, you just, Jesus, how do you even leave the house? Some of them are absolutely awful. But the point is, you know, every single one of those stories that they've read out, it's always come from a good place. You know, they never intended to do anything wrong. It's just that something has happened that was wrong, and then and it's just absolutely stuck with them, and they're absolutely mortified. And I think, again, addressing it head on, addressing guilt and shame head on. If you've done something bad, and you know you've done something bad, and everybody knows you've done something bad, face up to it. Me, hands up, done it. Yeah, we can move on then. I can fix it. We can go for that.
Or if you can't fix it, you can at least apologise.
Yes.
And be genuine in your apology.
Absolutely.
But you can't undo it.
No.
Even if you can fix it, you're always going to have done the thing.
Yes.
But,
yeah.
you know...
But then when it comes to other things, you know, if you're feeling a sense of shame for embarrassing events, again, it's kind of, it's a very destructive emotion, because it can eat away at you.
Yes.
But I would find it hard to recommend a course of action that encompasses everything in order to get past that. I suppose one of the things you could do, when I've got the fear, I've gone to the lengths of engineering a conversation over social media in order for me to bring up the event that happened that night where I think I've done something wrong, to find out whether or not I had.
Yeah.
And that, to me, now, reflecting on that, which I've done a few times, is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. All you have to do is text somebody and go, "Was I all right last night?"
Yeah.
And it would have been fine.
Yeah.
But what we now have with our group of friends, which I think is really lovely, when there's three or four of us who are always very...
Yes.
Very nervous the next day, we have a tacit agreement that nothing... It's an understanding before anything happens that nothing we do would ever be considered offensive or wrong. And if it was, we would be told at the time.
Yeah.
We are almost described as the inoffendables just because it helps us to get past that. Yeah. And it's not just when you're out on the piss. It's all the time. You know, text messages and emails and WhatsApp. The intonation of a semicolon or a comma or a full stop or an exclamation mark can mean so many different things to the interpreter.
Yeah, texting someone or putting a full stop at the end of a text message can make it look not I think aggressive is the wrong word, but it can make it look very sort of formal and bad tempered. And you know, I've replied to, I said fine. So if you say fine, then could you, or okay, it's like, yeah, right, okay, I'll see you. That if someone says right, I'll see you then, and you just reply with okay,
yeah,
that can be seen as yeah, great, okay, or it can be seen as okay, and that with the bad connotations behind that, you know, it can be like, well, I'm not happy about it, but
okay,
and I'm sure you could use grammar to get a context across, but if you're replying back with
one word,
a quick text message. I mean, I know some people use KK for when it's good. Everything okay. Good.
Yeah, I think to have a predefined code is sometimes quite useful. But I'll be honest, into this day and age, I find using memes quite good.
Yes. Yeah.
Because you know, a picture of, I don't know, a picture of a fluffy rabbit with two thumbs up, you can't really take that negatively, can you?
So no.
It kind of works. I don't think we've really scratched the surface of guilt and shame today. I think it's such a rich and deep topic. And I think it's worthy of reviewing and revisiting. I think there's a lot of evidence and a lot of information out there which we could touch on, but we would be talking ad nauseum, and I don't think anybody wants that.
No.
So we'll come back to it in a few weeks' time. But yeah, please do feedback on your experiences of guilt and shame. I mean, we haven't really touched anything about survivor's guilt on this particular episode, more than just to mention it. We haven't talked about how we talk about guilt when it comes to offending or the criminal justice. There's this whole gamuts of that, and when we're talking about shame, but you know, John Ronson's book, "So You've Been Publicly Shamed," that you know, a misstep on social media can literally ruin people's lives, and I think that's something we should look into on another episode.
Yeah.
So look out for Guilt and Shame Part 2, which doesn't sound much fun, but I'm sure it'd be quite interesting. So on that note, we'll round up for this week, and on the socials again at Thinking Habits, and email podcast@thinkinghabits.co.uk if you've got anything you'd like to say. So keep talking, and if you need to talk, you know where we are. Bye.
Bye.